Many years ago, there was a television program that was entitled Father Knows Best. I think it was Robert Young and June Lockhart who starred in that. If I'm wrong, one of you come to me after the service, please, and correct me. I have borrowed that title, Father Knows Best, to use as the title of this message today. And of course, the Father that I have in mind is none other than God himself. The story that Moses, the author of Genesis, will next tell us in our ongoing study of the book of Genesis is a story about dating and engagement and marriage. More precisely, it is a story about finding the right person to marry. And most precisely, it is the story of how God faithfully guides in the everyday circumstances of life. Truly, Father knows best. The story then is ultimately not only about dating and marriage, but it is ultimately about a Father God who is at work in the details of our lives, as well as in the lives of Abraham and his family. And so my question of you, for you to ponder even during this message, is this, and that is, how is God at work in your life? And I don't mean just in those macro senses that somehow it all turns out in the wash. I do mean, how is he at work in your daily life, moving and guiding and arranging so that his purposes and your good is truly achieved? Are you the victim of blind fate in life? Or do you have a Father God who is involved at every turn? I'm convinced that what Moses wanted his readers to believe and to stake their lives on, and remember, Moses, the author, is writing to the descendants of Abraham, the children of Jacob, otherwise known as Israel. He's writing to them at a time when they are going into the promised land again, out of Egypt. And what he wanted them to stake their lives on was that God faithfully worked in the life situations of Abraham, and he would work in their lives as well, and in ours. Now we turn to the story itself. 3 years after the death of Sarah, Abraham was 140 years old. But much more important than Abraham's age was the age of his son, Isaac. Isaac was 40 years of age, and much more importantly, he was unmarried. 65 years earlier, God had called Abraham out of his father's household and country to go to a land that God would show him, a land that would one day belong to all of Abraham's descendants. And God also promised Abraham that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars of the sky and as the grains of the seashore. 65 years later, with only one unmarried son, Abraham could certainly wonder how God could possibly bring all of that to pass. But Abraham had seen God faithfully act in the past, and this time Abraham does not wonder what God will do. Abraham acts. And he acts not in disbelief as he had done in times past, but this time he acts in faith. And when I say he acts in faith, I mean just that. Not that he sits idly by and says, well, something might happen, but that Abraham acts, believing that God will do something. Abraham acts. The future of Abraham's family and the promises of God hang on this 40-year-old bachelor becoming a husband and a father. Therefore, Isaac needs a wife. Kevin Lehman, in his book entitled The Birth Order Book, included this ad from a major newspaper. Christian, blonde, blue eyes, 5'2", 100 pounds, professional female, no dependents, wishes to meet Protestant Christian, professional man in 30s, with a college degree, who has compassion for animals and people, loves nature, exercise and physical fitness, no team sports, music, church and home life. desires non-smoker, non-drinker, slender, 5 feet 7 inches to 6 feet, lots of head hair, intelligent, honest, trustworthy, sense of humor, excellent communicator of feelings, very sensitive, gentle, affectionate, giving, encouraging, and helpful to others. No temper or ego problems, extremely considerate and dependable. I believe in old-fashioned morals and values. If you do and are interested in a possible Christian commitment, write to the following box. Please include recent photo, color photo and address. What are the chances of anyone answering that ad? I wonder if she might consider upping the ante a little bit and raising the bar somehow. I wonder if Isaac tried the personals column in the Beersheba Gazette. Probably not. Probably because it was customary in that day, Abraham took it on himself to find a wife for Isaac. And thus we come to the opening scene of the story. We find the old man Abraham talking to his most trusted servant, and he asks his servant to do a most important task. In fact, he asks his servant to take an oath that he will do it, and that is to find the right son, the right girl for his son to marry. But Abraham said there are two criteria. One, she must not be from around here. She cannot be a Canaanite woman. Secondly, she needs to be from my family, back from where I came 65 years ago. Now, the servant is very loyal, but he is not stupid. And so he asks a very astute question. What if I find a girl, but she won't come back here with me? Then he adds an idea. Shall I take your son back there instead? Now, that seems like a very reasonable thing to suggest. He certainly cannot take an oath that he knows he can't, or that he suspects that he might not be able to fulfill. How about the seemingly much better idea of taking the son back to that home country where he can be among all of the eligible girls? Wouldn't he have a far better chance of finding someone? Well, that suggestion causes Abraham to come right up off of his rug. And with voices raised, Abraham says, that is the one thing you must not do. Under no circumstances are you to take my son back to my home country. For God had promised me with an oath that this land would belong to my descendants. And what Abraham will not do is he will not compromise the will of God in order to accomplish the plan of God. The end does not justify the means. Abraham had before messed everything up by trying to accomplish God's plans with Abraham's methods. And Abraham apparently had learned his lesson. He must trust God not only with the outcome, but he also must trust God with how the outcome will come to pass. This is how he expressed his faith in God's involvement, not just in the ultimate outcome. It expresses his faith in how God will be involved in the very process. Verse 7, the Lord, the God of heaven, will send his angel before you so that you can get a wife for my son from there. Now, I think that is a marvelous statement, and it indicates the great place to which Abraham had come in his faith. God had promised Abraham that his son would be the beginning of a great nation. Therefore, his son must have a wife and children. Therefore, Abraham believes that God will somehow bring all of that to pass. God will certainly act in the process to bring about that end. So he said to his servant, you can go knowing, not hoping, knowing that God will go with you. You can go knowing that God will be involved in the very details of this experience. The Apostle Paul wrote in Philippians 1:6, I am confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. I must confess that I have most often thought of that verse in terms of the completion. What I think I have most often missed is how he will carry it on, day by day by day, piece by piece, event by event, the things in life that we consider so inconsequential, that God is at work guiding, directing, bringing to pass in exactly the right way. God's purposes for each of us are quite clear. He desires us to be like Jesus in attitude and in conduct. He desires for us to be useful in the building of his kingdom. And the promise is that he will do that in every detail of life. Jesus said, I will never leave you. I will never abandon you. I am with you always. Is that true? Is God present and active at work in our lives, in your life? The servant agreed to Abraham's terms and he took the oath. So his challenge were these. One, to find a wife for Isaac. Secondly, to find a wife not from among the local girls. Thirdly, to find a wife from Abraham's family a great distance away. And fourthly, never to take Isaac back there to find her. So the servant saddled up 10 camels, loaded them with goodies, and he went the 450 miles to the place from where Abraham had come. We move then to the next scene. For very quickly in the story, we find that the servant and his camels and the others who are attending are 450 miles away a couple of weeks later. Now, if I was that servant, I believe that all during those days of traveling, I would have been tempted to wonder, how on earth am I going to know which is the right girl? What am I supposed to do? Pull into town with 10 camels? Find a place for them to stay? Hang out on the street girl watching until what? Until I figure out who this is? How am I supposed to know which is the right girl for Isaac? Abraham's servant is smarter than that. He is acting on Abraham's behalf, and apparently he also has Abraham's faith. Very interesting to me, just an aside. Here's this probably slave man. Whether he was acquired in the new land where Abraham had moved, or whether it's possible he was nearly as old as Abraham and had come with him, nonetheless, during the years that he was with Abraham, he had come to know, respect, love, and trust Abraham's God. So instead of whining about how he is going to accomplish this task, like his master Abraham, this servant devises a plan. He puts his faith into action, trusting that God is with him and that God will be faithful in the very process. The servant makes a plan. Now, the kind of woman that would be suitable for his master's son, that is the kind of woman who would be able to mother the nation of Israel to be, would need to be a certain kind of woman. So what the servant decided to do was to go to the city well. There, healthy, strong young women would come. But secondly, he prayed. He prayed as he devised a test by which he would determine, at least in part, who the right woman was. Now, his dependence is absolutely on God, not on his ingenuity. But nonetheless, though his faith is in God, he plans with creativity. Genesis 24, verses 12 to 14. Then he prayed, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, give me success today and show kindness to my master Abraham. See, I am standing beside this spring, and the daughters of the town people are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a girl, please let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink, and I'll water your camels too, let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. Now the servant's test asked not only common civility and courtesy, mark this woman. He didn't only want a woman who would be common in that courtesy, but he wanted her to be marked by uncommon courtesy, a servanthood mentality that would truly be uncommon. He would ask her for a drink, for that would be necessary. She would certainly never initiate a conversation with a man or a stranger. He would have to make the first move. Now, whether she responds at all to him will be part of the test. It's a good sign. If she goes further and offers to give water to the others who are traveling with him, that would even be a better sign. But in his test, he is going to ask for a further remarkable extra. Would she be willing to volunteer? Not just comply with, but would she of her own accord volunteer to water the 10 camels as well? No small feat. But What if no unmarried woman comes to the well that day? What if every woman he asks for a drink turns away shyly or abruptly? What if no woman offers to do anything other than give him a drink? What if two different women hear his request and both offer him something to drink? How is he supposed to determine which is the right woman? Now, the servant doesn't believe that this test that he has devised, that alone will determine which woman is the right woman. He believes that God is actively involved in every detail of life, and he is simply trusting God in the process to lead him to the right conclusion. So that even if a young woman voluntarily offers to water his camels, the servant still needs to find out more about her. But first things first, does any woman come along who is willing to not only give him a drink, but in fact offer to water the camels? Verse 14, before he had finished praying, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. The girl was very beautiful. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up again. I want you to notice the first phrase. Before he had even finished praying. The author wants us to know that God is so immediately involved that God is acting even before the servant has finished praying. In fact, I think it's suggested, as we will see, that God is involved long before the servant even began to pray. In our lives, we are far too tempted to call such things simple coincidence. But God works in our lives by design. I think we in the future will learn with amazement the kinds of things that God has done in the past and the various ways that he has touched different lives many, many years before that finally converge in this situation or that situation. God at work. I know that I told this story nearly 3 years ago, but I think it bears repeating in this context. It was 1948, 3 years after the conclusion of World War II, and a man named Marcel, who was then nearly 50 years of age, took his usual 9:09 morning train from his suburban home, and he headed into New York City. On that particular morning, however, he decided to change trains and visit a friend in Brooklyn, even as he was going to work. After the visit, he took the Manhattan-bound train to go to his office. The subway car was rather crowded, but a seat opened up, and Marcel sat down next to a man who was reading a Hungarian language newspaper. Having himself come from Hungary, Marcel struck up a conversation with the man, only to learn that the man, whose name was Bella, had come from a city named Debrecen, a city that Marcel knew well. During the war, Bella had been sent to a German labor camp, and afterwards he had been liberated by the Russians, but he had been taken to Russia to serve further. When he was finally released after the war, he made his way back to his hometown of Debrecen. When he found his way to the apartment building where his parents had lived, he discovered that they were all gone, and the apartments were inhabited by others, and no one knew of his family's whereabouts. He went from there to the apartment that he and his wife had shared, and he found likewise that they were all gone. The apartment was occupied by strangers who knew nothing about him or his wife. As he was leaving the apartment building, a young boy who had lived in the neighborhood recognized him and said to him that his whole family had been killed and that his wife had been taken to Auschwitz, one of the worst of the German concentration camps. After weeks of fruitless searching, Bella finally gave up hope, and he set out on foot to leave Europe. He managed to immigrate to the United States just 3 months before Marcel met him. As Bella was telling his story, Marcel could not help but think of the young woman that he had met a year earlier, the young woman who had said that she too had come from Debrecen. She had told how she had been taken to Auschwitz and that she had escaped from there or had been freed from that, liberated by the Americans and not able to find any of her family, she finally was brought to the United States. Marcel had been so moved by her story that he wrote her name and her phone number down on a piece of paper and stuck it into his coat a year earlier. He fished that piece of paper out of his coat on the subway train that day, and he turned to Bella and he said, "Is there any chance that your wife's name is Maria?" Turning pale, Bella said, "Yes, how did you know?" Marcel said, "Let's get off the train." He took a stunned Bella by the arm and he led him to a phone booth where he called the number that he had on that piece of paper. The phone was not in Maria's apartment. It was in the hallway outside of the apartment, and Maria had never answered that phone before. Always others were in the building and they would answer it, but it continued to ring, and it rang so long that she recognized no one else was going to answer, and so she responded. Marcel asked her to describe her husband and to give her address in De Brecon. And then he asked her to hold the line phone for just a minute while he asked Bella if he lived at such and such a street address. And at that, Marcel said to Bella, "Something miraculous is about to happen. Here, take the phone. Talk to your wife." Bella's eyes filled with tears as he took the phone, and listening for the first time in a long time to his wife's voice, he simply began to mumble hysterically. Marcel took the phone back and told Maria to stay where she was, and he sent her husband to her. And that day, a reunion took place, like few reunions. The person who retold this story, when I read it, said this: was that reunion by mere chance? Did chance introduce Marcel to Maria a year earlier? Did chance cause Marcel to take a different train that day? Did chance cause Bella to be reading a Hungarian newspaper at that very time? Was it chance, or did God ride the Brooklyn subway that morning? In our story from Genesis, Moses makes certain that as we read the story, we understand it was not coincidence that brought Rebekah to the well at that very time, before he had even finished praying. She appeared. It was God. And so we expect what we hear next, verse 17. The servant hurried to meet her and he said, "Please give me a little water from your jar." "Drink, my lord," she said, and she quickly lowered the jar to her hands and gave him a drink. After she had given him a drink, she said, "I'll draw water for your camels too until they are finished drinking." You say, "I knew it. I knew that was the girl. Knew it all along. When I heard Rebecca, that was for her." But the servant's wiser than that. Verse 21. Without saying a word, the man watched her closely to learn whether or not the Lord had made his journey successful. He was watching to know whether, in fact, this is the right woman. Two of the conditions that Abraham had laid down were these. One, go to my country and to my relatives to get a wife for my son Isaac. She's definitely from the right country. Now the question is she from the right family? Verse 23. Then he asked, "Whose daughter are you?" Now the next words out of that girl's mouth are what Moses' readers wanted to hear. When those first readers of this story heard these words, they were able to say, as we might have said just a moment ago, "I knew it. I knew that was the right girl." Now, it may be a little more obscure for us because we don't know the history as well, but look at verse 24. She said, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son that Milcah bore to Nahor. My father is Bethuel, and my father's father is Nahor." Now, what the servant heard was that that young woman was the granddaughter of Nahor. Do you remember who Nahor was? He is the brother of Abraham. Terah had three sons that we know of: Abraham, Haran, and Nahor. Nahor married Milcah. They had a son named Bethuel, Bethuel and his wife had a daughter named Rebekah. She's from the right country. She's from the right family. And when the servant heard those words, our text tells us he is so keenly aware of the activity of God in his life that he stopped right then and he praised God. Verses 26 and 27. Then the man bowed down and worshiped the Lord, saying, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness to my master. As for me, the Lord has led me on the journey to the house of my master's relatives." Just as Abraham had said it would happen, "The Lord will go with you." So it had happened. God is in it. But the matter is not settled. He knows he has the right girl, but he has not heard if she'll respond. And he certainly has not heard if the family will consent. So the third scene in the story moves us to Rebekah's home. And there the servant must convince everyone present that his master Abraham and his master's son Isaac is the right man. And again, even though the servant knows that God is in this, he does not simply go to the house expecting that everyone is going to jump for joy at the idea of this stranger taking this girl off to some other country. He knows that he is going to have to do something. Still trusting God, understanding God is in the whole thing, he still must make his case. And he does so. He does it by emphasizing four things. Number one, he emphasizes his master's wealth. Not a bad place to start, I suppose. Verse 34, I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has blessed my master abundantly, and he has become wealthy. Secondly, he emphasizes Isaac's age. It wouldn't have taken those family members long to figure out that if Nahor is the brother of Abraham and Isaac is the son of Abraham, then Isaac and Bethuel must be about the same age, which would make him old enough to be Rebekah's grandfather or father. So what does he say? Verse 36, my master's wife Sarah has borne him a son in her old age. Thus Isaac could be as little as only 10 years older than Rebekah. Third fact, Isaac will inherit all the wealth that now belongs to Abraham. Verse 36 again, and he has given Isaac everything he owns. Fourth fact, God has obviously guided in this process. And what the servant then does, and what makes the chapter so long, is that he emphasizes every detail of how God was at work in the process. He told him how that his master Abraham had said the angel would go before you. He told him how that he had prayed asking God for his help when he got to the well. He told him about the highly unusual test, exceedingly high standard test, if you will, that he had prepared. He told him how that even before he had finished praying, Rebekah came along. He told him that she did exactly what he had prayed would happen, and that she was exactly from the right family. And then he told them how he had prayed, thanking God. Then the servant popped the question. Verse 49. Now, if you will show kindness and faithfulness to my master, tell me, and if not, tell me, so I may know which way to turn. Yes or no? Will you send your daughter, your sister, with me to be married to Isaac? To that, Rebekah's brother Laban and Rebekah's father Bethuel respond. Verse 50, this is from the Lord. Here's Rebekah. Take her and go. Let her become the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has directed. And again, the servant worshiped God. In fact, he went down on his face on the ground, right there in front of all those people. No indication, by the way, that these people believe in God the way Abraham, his master, believes in God. For later we find that, in fact, Laban, her brother, had other gods as well. But right in front of all of them, down to the ground he goes. When Abraham's servant heard what they said, he bowed down to the ground before the Lord. The next morning, the servant wanted to get on his way immediately. He knew his task was now nearly completed. He wanted to go home to Abraham and Isaac with this bride-to-be. But Rebekah's brother and Rebekah's mother suggest that they wait for some period of time before leaving. The servant recognizes that as a threat, and he insists that they leave immediately. Promised land. And that brings us to the final scene of the story. It's now 450 miles later on camelback, probably at least 2 weeks later. Isaac is out away from his tents, the text says, meditating. It's in the evening, and he notices a caravan approaching from a great distance away. Rebekah also sees someone out in the field, and undoubtedly she was aware that they were getting close to where they were supposed to be going, and she asks, who is the man who's out there? She is told by the servant that that is Isaac, his master. And as was customary in that day, because she was then engaged, she covered her face with a veil. The servant went on ahead and told Isaac everything that had happened, and we are not told how long these next events took. We are simply told that Isaac then married Rebekah. In fact,
The story ends so abruptly, you would think if this was simply a love story that this would be that this final scene would be the biggest one. It would be the longest. It would be with the most detail. But no, it ends so abruptly that we realize that though the marriage is very important, it is not the reason for all the detail of this story. Last week, when we looked at the account of the death of Isaac's mother, Sarah, we discovered quickly that Sarah had little to do with the story. It was really a story about the promised land. This week, though, the story is importantly about Isaac's marriage to Rebekah, because we know that through them is going to come this great nation that had been promised to Abraham. The issue that is impressed most of all on those first readers and on us is God's faithfulness and God's involvement in every step, every detail of their lives. Many years later, the writer of Proverbs wrote these words: "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight." I think the question that Moses, were he preaching this text, even as he told the story, could ask of his readers, as I can ask of you, and that is, do you believe that? I mean, truly believe it. Do you believe that God is at work in your life? Again, not in just the macro sense of, yes, I know I'll go to heaven when I die, but do you believe that God is at work in your life today? Is He at work in your life of business, of employment, in your home, in the details of life? Do you then seek His counsel, as did this servant? Do you expect and watch for His working in your life, as did this servant? And do you thank Him for His faithfulness in working in every detail of life? What's going on in your life now? Right now? What's happening in your family? What's happening in your employment? What's happening in your relationships with other people? Out of what kinds of circumstances have you come, or what kinds of things do you anticipate are going to soon be happening in your life? Can you see down the road 2 years or 5 years or 10 years? Can you imagine? And do you understand that God is at work in all of those ways to guide our lives? Pray with me, please.